Okay, my name is John Beck, and I co-direct our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And without the Greenwoods, I'm actually going to have to walk but further back in terms of handing out the announcements that I'm about to hand out. So thank you for coming. And this is the last brown bag of the fall semester, but we have a perfectly good set of brown bags coming up in the spring semester. So feel free, I'll just ask Mark to come up and take as many as you want, hand them to friends and family. They're perfect for the refrigerator. And let me just announce that the first brown bag, just like this brown bag, is co-sponsored by Motor Cities, the Lansing Stewardship Community of the Automobile National Heritage Area. The one that leads off in the spring is on Friday, January 10th, when Ashley Johnson is coming up from Northwestern University from the Department of History to talk about illegal Detroiters, undocumented Europeans, and unions in America's Motor City, 1924 to 1942. So please do come back for that. So Mark, if I can just hand that to you, you can just hand them back and someone will hand them on to the next person. So thank you, thank you. And feel free, I hope, to sign in. We always love to find out who's here and to keep in touch. So today, let me give you just 2 seconds of background on the fact that Dr. Lisa Fine from the History Department here at Michigan State spoke on a related topic to today's topic earlier in this Brown Bag series. And the reason I find this so interesting is I come out of the paper industry originally. And in the paper industry, environmentalism and trade unionism have often been regarded as enemies because of the fact that paper mills are often opposed by environmentalists, and it's looked at as a jobs issue by trade unions. So it's always interesting to see when there's a convergence. Right now, for those of you who aren't aware of it, there's something called the Blue-Green Alliance that currently exists, spearheaded by my union, United Steelworkers. Paper workers went into the steelworkers a few years ago. And that really is trying to build on the tradition you're going to hear about today, which is the tradition of labor unions and environmentalists working together, or labor unions working on behalf of the whole notion of kind of a working class environmentalism. It makes all the sense in the world, but at times it seemed counterintuitive. So I'm hoping that Brandon will help us understand that today. Brandon Ward is lucky enough to be at Purdue University working with Nancy Gaben, a very, very fine labor historian who did her own personal work at the University of Michigan under Sidney Fine. And Nancy's been one of the experts on women in the UAW, among other things. And so he's been one of her doctoral students and is here today to talk about that research. He doesn't hail from Michigan, he hails from Colorado, famous auto-making state that is. But today he's with us to talk on the topic, Confronting the Chrome-Plated Wasteland, the UAW, Working Class Environmentalism, and the Urban Crisis in Detroit. So please help me in welcoming Brandon Ward to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Well, thank you, Professor Beck. I think that was the absolute perfect setup for what I'm going to talk about today. And thank you all for being here. I really appreciate being invited. I'm honored to be a part of this really excellent slate of speakers that Professor Beck has organized. And hopefully I can finish off this semester's group strong. To give a bit of a background on this, I'm presenting today a piece of a larger project, which is a dissertation I'm finishing up in the History Department at Purdue University on the origins of the environmental justice movement in Detroit. And in that, I look at the different strains of activism and the different processes of regional development that made the environmental justice movement possible by the 1980s. And environmental justice is usually characterized as grassroots environmental protest, usually of environmental inequalities, particularly in the form of exposure to toxic chemicals, for instance, and unequal environmental risk. And it's historically been most associated with black civil rights protests, but it's also a movement more generally of working class people asserting their right to a healthy living and working environment. It really, this environmental justice movement really seemed to burst on the scenes in the early 1980s with really high profile incidents like the Love Canal incident and some other really high profile incidents of dumping toxic waste in African American neighborhoods. But what I'm going to try to show for you today is that there is a longer history of working class environmentalism that really feeds into this, into the growth of, or into the birth of the environmental justice movement by the 1980s. And I think this working class environmentalism is a crucial part of that story. So first I want to just address what is working class environmentalism and what does it have to do with the urban crisis. And primarily today I'm going to be talking about the period from about the 1960s to the early 1970s. And in this period, working class environmentalism in Detroit focused on local urban landscapes more than it did distant wilderness or more mainstream environmentalist issues like overproduction, overconsumption, overpopulation of overconsumption of natural resources, sorry. And while these issues weren't necessarily absent from the minds of workers and unionists, at least a lot of what they were doing in the 1960s and early 1970s had a lot more to do with protecting the communities in which workers lived from air and water pollution, urban decay. And I was really, these unionists were really interested in environmental health issues also related to the workplace. So I would argue that, also argue that working class environmentalism, far more than the mainstream environmental movement that's most often associated with the new left and the middle class and elites, has been deeply, deeply concerned with issues of social justice. Particularly by the end of the 1960s, they were crafting a powerful critique of environmental inequality based on race and class. This would provide an important precursor to the environmental justice movement that I just mentioned is usually assumed to have begun in the early 1980s. And while there were many streams feeding the environmental justice movement, I think this working class environmentalism is an important precursor. So a lot of times, as Professor Beck has mentioned, the media focuses on the tensions between workers and environmentalists. One of the more high profile of these conflicts was the conflicts between loggers and environmentalists in the Pacific Northwest in the 1980s over the endangered spotted owl. In Oregon, you could spot people driving around with bumper stickers reading, "Are you an environmentalist or do you work for a living?" And while I don't want to downplay the fact that sometimes there are some very serious conflicts existing between workers and environmentalists, focusing on working class expressions of environmentalism shows that common ground can in fact be found, and that the working class has a lot to offer the mainstream environmental movement, if only it will listen. Our usual understanding of the relationship between workers and the environment usually hinges on this tension between choosing jobs versus the environment. It's how it's usually framed in popular discussions and in the mainstream media. But in the 1960s and early 1970s, workers indicated that they were unwilling to go too far in trading the health of their families and their communities in order to let industries get away with what was at this period pretty much limitless air and water pollution. Unfortunately, as we'll see, during this period, this working class environmentalism was kind of a fleeting expression. And by the mid-1970s, workers were really put on the defensive by domestic and global economic challenges. And they became far more susceptible to the argument that environmental regulation cost jobs. So when I tell folks that I'm doing a study, researching and writing on Detroit, they ask, why Detroit? And this is especially because my family's back from Colorado. I had no compelling ties to the region, but it's a place that I've since come to really appreciate and really love, and the people in Detroit have all been incredibly, incredibly generous to me. But why Detroit? I had long been interested in this intersection between labor and the environment. It was particularly through my experiences working with environmental causes that I came to start to sort of understand the fact that the perspective of class was really missing in a lot of these causes that environmentalists and a lot of my environmentalist friends were advocating. I had sort of discovered within these environmentalist circles that cities were often put on the back burner, not necessarily being seen as places that were deserving of our attention as environmentalists. The issues of poverty and the very different sort of environmental context in which poor and working people lived was not considered really a necessary or a pressing concern for these environmentalists. And I saw this as being really a part of a problem of seeing cities as sacrifice zones. And that is to say, that's a term that's really popular in the sociological literature on environmentalism. But that is to say, sacrifice zones say that it's okay to sacrifice both the environment and working class and black bodies in order to generate the enormous amount of wealth coming from the cities that pours out into the suburbs, and which then the suburbs then kind of get to disavow of having any responsibility for. So these were some of the concerns that I was interested in addressing, and I just needed to find the right place to locate the study. I initially had planned on doing a sort of national study of these issues, and Detroit was going to be just one part of that story, but when I first came up to Detroit to study it, I figured out that it was just this sort of Pandora's box, and that I could never be fully come to all the answers that I wanted to just by studying Detroit. So I decided that I wanted to do a deeper study on Detroit, and it was just a place that was endlessly fascinating for me, and I knew that it'd be one that would provide plenty of intellectual fodder. So I put these two photos up because I think they illustrate a point that I want to make at the outset. And I'm not the first one to make the comparison between these two famous depictions of industry in Detroit. On the one hand, on the left side, we have Charles Sheeler's famous crisscross conveyors, part of a series of pictures that he took in 1927 and 1928 of the Ford River Rouge complex, massive, massive complex in Dearborn, Michigan. And these images by Charles Sheeler captured the country's imagination. They portrayed a confidence in American industrial might, a sense of wonder at the promise of technology. They assert a sense of power and domination even over, and even challenge the limits of nature themselves. And while a handful of Sheeler's photographs showed men at work, overwhelmingly, the most commercially successful of his pictures were completely absent of any and completely neglected the workers who made those great machines run. On the other hand, on the right side, we have the equally famous, if not more famous, Diego Rivera mural. This is just one of many murals at the located at the Detroit Institute of Arts, a place that's unfortunately now kind of under a lot of duress and has an unsure future. And in contrast with the Sheeler photograph, this image, I think, depicts industry in a very different light. Not necessarily critiquing industry, but which shows the busy hive of workers and puts workers and industry within the context of the natural world, and really shows the relationship between the raw natural resources and the men who turn those into a finished final product. And I would argue that in many ways these two competing visions of views of Detroit, one with Detroit as an idea, like with what I see on the left side, and the other, which places workers at the center of the story and within their environmental context, are two competing interpretations. And working class environmentalism in Detroit, I think, is part of an attempt to put people and nature back into the center of the story of industrial Detroit. So already in the 1940s, workers were voicing their concerns over the precarious state of the environment. They were often keenly aware of the environmental degradation through their lived experiences. You know, they could see it in the skies, they could smell it in the air, they could see it in the water, they could see it in the fish, the dead fish that were washing up on the banks of the rivers. They could see it in the dead ducks washing up on the banks of the Detroit River. And it was, you know, destroying their favorite fishing holes, their favorite hunting spots. And working class environmentalism in the immediate post-World War II years often focused on preserving outdoor recreation opportunities. This was a fact that was dramatically illustrated at Rio Motors here in Lansing, as Professor Lisa Fine has argued, when the UAW local union there made breaks during hunting season a key part of the collective bargaining process. And increases in prosperity meant little to UAW members if they didn't have healthful natural escapes in which to enjoy their leisure time, places where they could escape the oppressive nature of the city and factory life. And early environmentalism by the UAW reflected a concern for providing places for the membership to escape from industrial Detroit for restorative relaxation. Solidarity, the UAW's official periodical, suggested ways that workers could use their increased leisure time, saying, quote, "As a higher standard of living is negotiated, it's obvious that union families are turning more to nature in order to enjoy the fragrance of clean air away from the factory. So many workers, you know, on the weekends spent pursued outdoor recreation, hunting, fishing, going camping, and the pages of Solidarity regular and the union local newspapers would regularly report on the hunting and fishing conditions." Recreation Department Director Olga Madar boasted, quote, "In our activities, we have attempted to provide energetic and purposeful leadership in all aspects of the community life, outside as well as inside the auto plants, especially in providing opportunities for swimming, fishing, and boating." By the mid-1960s, in a lot of ways, the United Auto Workers took the lead in terms of advocating for environmental protection, which was not so much a new departure as it was an outgrowth in this earlier union efforts to promote outdoor recreation and camping and fishing and conservation of wilderness. UAW President Walter Reuther cemented his support for Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society by gladly pushing LBJ's environmental initiatives. And in return, LBJ allowed Reuther to share the stage with him at the groundbreaking White House Conference on Natural Beauty in May 1965. UAW President Walter Reuther enthusiastically supported the Great Society, seeing it as the moment at which the UAW's alliance with the Democratic Party would finally pay off. So Johnson introduced his beautification program at this White House conference in 1965, and Time magazine reported on the welcome reception across the United States to that beautification agenda, saying that none of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society inaugural promises has produced such a glad commotion as his declaration that natural beauty should replace man-made ugliness in America. Giving the opening remarks to that conference, Lady Bird Johnson famously declared that ugliness is bitterness and connected the need for beautification to complement the overall Great Society agenda. Walter Reuther was invited to address the gathering. While highlighting the importance of conserving natural areas and wildlife, Johnson and Reuther focused much of their messages on cleaning up and revitalizing the urban environment. Echoing many of the concerns that liberal intellectuals like John Kenneth Galbraith had expressed regarding pollution as a product excesses of consumption, Johnson lamented that pollution had become, quote, "a plague and a menace to the American scene." Regulations and better enforcement of environmental protection laws could help remedy some of those excesses, but Johnson suggested that federal efforts should primarily be seen as a supplement to the responsibilities of local communities, quote, "supported by active and concerned citizens." The UAW's membership provided a ready source of those concerned citizens, and Reuther promised that his membership could take up that fight. Reuther echoed many of Johnson's concerns, suggesting that man does not live on bread alone, but that the quality of life now depended on not just what one could buy, but the quality of their surroundings. Apathy and neglect created, quote, "a chrome-plated wasteland in the cities, but vigorous action could create urban forms full of beauty and human fulfillment." At this early point, taking a strong position on environmental protection had limited downside for Reuther and the UAW, serving to solidify the union's support for the Great Society on an issue growing in popularity with auto workers. Not long after the White House conference, the UAW took stage nationally on its own with the United Action for Clear Water conference, which was held just a few months later in Detroit in November 1965. Some 1,000 folks attended, representing government agencies, labor unions, big business, and concerned citizens from both Canada and the United States. Some prominent members of the Johnson administration attended, including Stuart Udall, who was in charge of the Department of Interior, who said that, quote, "This coupling of enlightened leadership and grassroots impetus is the genius of two great new waves, the new wave of conservation and the new wave of unionism. And I submit that together, these two waves constitute a considerable tide of the future." The Federal Water Pollution Control Administration chief, Murray Stein, also spoke at the conference, and he argued that the UAW was uniquely positioned to respond to pollution since its members were on the front lines of that pollution in Detroit's factories. He framed it in a way that I think is useful for thinking about working class environmentalism. He said, quote, "The water pollution issue has the peculiarity of being both a national, nonpartisan, long-range concern and a bread and butter issue of the greatest immediacy for its membership." And I find Stein's remarks interesting because they reflect the work, reflect that working class environmentalism wasn't about the environment as an amenity that you should be able to enjoy only when you reach a certain economic threshold, but that the environment should be something that's protected that, for all workers, for all people, and provides a livelihood for all people, and that protecting the environment would indeed protect the health of workers. Indeed, he calls it a bread and butter issue. The UAW wanted to use the momentum from the conference to spur on greater grassroots participation in environmental issues and called it a citizens' crusade against water pollution. By early 1967, the UAW was moving on to create one of the earliest and most unique attempts in the country to organize and mobilize community members, particularly auto workers, to organize against pollution. And this was something called the Pollution Action Line. It was first located in Detroit, and then it's replicated by other union locals nationally. And this Pollution Action Line, or the PAL, was really the first attempt by UAW leadership to organize grassroots action on environmental problems. They were interested in developing a group of citizen observers who could report air and water pollution, publicizing the worst offenders, and holding factories responsible for violating regulations. But the way, because the way a lot of environmental policy in Detroit, in the Detroit area worked, and also in the country at large in many cases, is inspectors were so understaffed, so underfunded, and in some cases had so little authority, really the only way that they could initiate an investigation is if they first received a citizen's complaint. The director of Detroit, and the Wayne County air pollution agencies pointed out that the territory of Puerto Rico had more money allocated for air pollution control than the entire state of Michigan. And of course, Michigan, where there was Michigan being a national industrial powerhouse and creating all the pollution problems that go along with it. The Pollution Action Line called on union locals to nominate members who could serve on PAL. And in some cases, like in Local 51, which was at the Plymouth factory in Hamtramck, Michigan, not only did they nominate someone, they also developed their own programs to encourage citizen participation in environmental politics, and over the next few years become one of the more active locals in promoting environmental education of its members and activism. Like at UAW 51, the biggest UAW local, Local 600, also independently developed environmental programs within its ranks, demonstrating once again that it wasn't only the national union leadership that was promoting environmental activism, but was also being done at the local level. UAW 600 is rather famous for being one of the most independent and radical UAW locals, representing the workers at the River Rouge complex, the one that I showed in that Charles Sheeler photograph earlier. And Local 600 kind of took the lead in the Downriver Detroit area, hosting its own pollution conference in August 1967. They brought in state legislators, pollution officials, auto workers, steel workers, clergymen, lobbyists, and concerned citizens to address environmental problems in Dearborn, which was home of Ford Motor Company and the River Rouge complex. Because they brought so many people to the table to discuss these issues, it really painted a remarkable portrait of the different positions that each of these groups held. One worker condemned the Merker Brick Company for operating a stack that, quote, emanated gasless fumes, which produced a toxicating effect and gave residents a burning sensation to the eyes, nose, and throat. Workers complained there that despite the enormous pollution problems, the city of Dearborn had not one official responsible for regulating pollution, and instead assigned that responsibility to an overworked boiler inspector. Other residents indicated that their concern for the environment was a matter of immediate health and security, rather than merely as this sort of aesthetic concern more common among middle-class environmentalists. One said that pollution was not merely a nuisance, but was particularly frightening and even oppressive on some days, she said. The same woman recognized that enforcing pollution abatement might incur some real costs in the forms of higher consumer prices and higher taxes, but she insisted that this was much better than what she was already having to pay out as far as higher doctor bills. And she remarks on the fact that everybody in her neighborhood has asthma and everybody's going to the doctor all the time. They can't hang their sheets out to dry, things of that nature. Others pointed out that whenever pollution or hazardous land use attracted too much on the fashionable subdivisions of the Ford executives, all they would have to do is raise Cain and have those problems, and they would have those problems quickly resolved. They said that it was evident that the level of pollution that was acceptable in economically secure neighborhoods was vastly different than what was deemed accessible in the impoverished neighborhoods. These residents poignantly illustrated the problem of environmental inequality and injustice before they had years before the environmental justice movement would give more people the language to do that. And I think these conferences and community activism like this was an important precursor to that environmental justice movement. We also see during the UAW 600 conference, Ford executives pushing the argument that pollution abatement measures would severely threaten the future of their jobs, a theme we would see come up more and more as the years would go on. And these industrialists argued that they had already been moving on implementing measures to reduce pollution. They already had plans to do more, but that doing any more than what they had already done and what was already in the works would threaten between a 1 and 3 year closure of their factories, thus threatening the workers' livelihoods in order to install that pollution abatement equipment, which was kind of an absurd projection to make. And in the coming years, this jobs blackmail would become a more prominent strategy on the part of industrialists to threaten working class environmentalists. Yet at this point, in the late 1960s, the power was still firmly on the side of workers who wished to advocate robust regulations. The union's shift toward concern in urban environmentalism got a giant shove with the Detroit risings, uprising, rebellion, whatever term we prefer, in the 6 days in July 1967 in the 12th Street area. In the flurry of the violence, 43 people died, 2,500 buildings were destroyed, and $36 million of damage, and the destruction exceeded $36 million in damage. One of the results of the uprising is that it focused attention on all aspects of life in Detroit, be it education, employment, police abuse, and even the environment. The 1967 uprisings gave more immediacy to the UAW's efforts to create a more healthful and livable urban environment. 4 months before the riots, the UAW had begun drawing a connection between the environment and the urban crisis. In its periodical, Solidarity, an article argued that environmental conditions of the inner city were symptomatic of the urban crisis, including dirty air, water pollution, and empty, idle land as evidence of urban decay. Walter Reuther's language also suggested the new urgency, as he said, quote, if our cities continue to decay, then the economic, political, and social fallout will be just as deadly and as inescapable as a nuclear fallout. Reuther explained that the difference between environments enjoyed by the more economically privileged who could enjoy open spaces in the suburbs and those who lived in the inner city. He contrasted that, saying, in cities, often the only open spaces are in the streets or are in vacant lots. It need not be so. It is possible to have both urbanization and civilization. Beauty, dignity, and cleanliness can exist anywhere that like-minded people set themselves to the task. Ruther explained that that the union's efforts underscored a new understanding of the, quote, total environment, saying the UAW's concerns for membership does not stop at the shop door. It extends into the total environment. And at this moment, the environment is deteriorating in several areas at once. So, beginning in 1969, the UAW's new Conservation and Resource Development Department took a more aggressive approach in organizing UAW members and inner city residents. In 1969, they launched the Downriver Anti-Pollution League to replace the Pollution Action Line. This new Downriver Anti-Pollution League, or DAPL, was aimed at raising consciousness and environmental activism within union locals and also among neighborhood residents, so not just among its own membership, but broadening their organizing scope to neighborhood residents. The Downriver Anti-Pollution League started scouting locations in the Downriver area in which they believed that they could make the greatest impact. With funding from the UAW and support staff of a couple of interns from the University of Michigan, they hit the pavement and interviewed neighborhood residents about their health and pollution concerns. They discovered environmental inequalities fell heaviest on black neighborhoods, and their investigations were an early step in making clear the connections between race and environmental inequality. They eventually settled on four downriver communities: River Rouge, Ecorse, Lincoln Park, and Wyandotte. In all their efforts, they self-consciously tried to empower neighborhood residents beyond just their own members, which is a significant departure from their earlier organizing efforts, which had been primarily centered on organizing just auto workers. So often these working class residents felt helpless to resist powerful industrial interests. And so often the most difficult and most important role that that DAPL could play was in convincing skeptical Detroiters that they could, in fact, make a difference in their communities and assert control over their environments and living conditions. DAPL was involved in doing all kinds of things, including holding rallies, marching on city halls, educating residents on the health effects of air and water pollution, and prepared them to testify in hearings against polluters. At the same time, the UAW worked in inner city black neighborhoods in order to improve local landscapes, including sponsoring cleanups, building recreational facilities, and starting an innovative Vest Pocket Parks program. In the wake of the Detroit riots, the UAW had a prominent place in the discussions on how to prevent another uprising and rebuild the city in a more sustainable and equitable fashion. And the UAW president, Walter Ruther, promised the resources of his union to help. One of the ways that the UAW lent its support was in promoting the role that the Deprived Areas Recreation Team, or DART, could play in reshaping the urban landscape. The Deprived Areas Recreation Team was semi-independent, with funding coming from the UAW and public sources, but it was closely associated with the union and had offices in Solidarity House, which is the UAW's headquarters in Detroit. Director of the UAW Recreation Department, Olga Madar, argued, "The tragic events of the past couple weeks," talking about the riots, "graphically justify the existence of DART." Years later, Madar would regret that groups like DART were not in place before the summer of 1967, believing that some of these programs could have helped solve what she called, quote, "the serious dereliction in terms of services based on race in this community." Rather than merely engaging in top-down urban renewal, the UAW also sought a more cooperative strategy of rebuilding with the help of the residents of these inner-city neighborhoods. By the UAW's count, some 40,000 UAW members lived in inner-city Detroit. In an address to DART, Reverend William T. Patrick Jr. of the United Community Services dramatized the need for positive spaces in the urban environment, saying, quote, "Last July 22nd, the subject of our common interest was recreation. On July 23rd, it became Wreck Creation, W-R-E-C-K Creation. Patrick argued that the tall order in front of them was nothing less than the recreation of a shattered city, recreation of a fragmented society, recreation of faith in the great American promise. The only way to restore faith in the urban environment was to, quote, face up to problems that have been swept under the rug for generations. So a major project of DART was the creation of these vest pocket parks, which I mentioned, which were these supposed to be safe, open spaces in the city, replacing abandoned lots in the inner city. A vest pocket parks committee was created, and they were adamant that contractors should hire members from the neighborhoods in which the parks were being constructed. Environmental improvement, they believed, could also offer a significant economic benefit to the neighborhoods and provide jobs for the black youths facing severe unemployment rates and deep frustration with the system. The committee worked out a deal with the Community Relations Commission, drafting an agreement that made such a requirement, stating, in order to qualify, a contractor must have a workforce that is representative of the ethnic composition of the city, with maximum utilization of area residents on the workforce. In the end, DART was successful in creating at least 14 vest pocket parks. The uprising and urban crisis also compelled the UAW to start thinking more clearly about metropolitan environmental inequality. That is, the way that the suburbs enjoyed more environmental amenities like parks and recreation opportunities, and fewer environmental hazards like air and water pollution and unwanted land uses than in the central city. And indeed, they considered metropolitan environmental inequality a serious factor in the urban crisis. One of the initiatives the UAW Recreation Department started to take in response was to organize inner city residents to demand a more equitable distribution of parks and recreation opportunities in the region. And particularly, they targeted the Metro Park system, which was a regional system of about 10 parks, several thousand acres in size, and everybody in the five-county Detroit region paid into the system. Yet there was not one single Metro Park located within the city of Detroit. All of them were located at least a half hour away at a time when some 40% of the residents of the central city had no access to a car. So the UAW mobilized inner city residents to testify at hearings and had modest success in getting at least some of the tax money shifted back to Detroit to improve Belle Isle, a major park much more accessible to inner city residents and the topic of a lot of debate recently. Here, the UAW was instrumental in bringing attention to environmental inequalities and helping to pioneer a language of distributive justice that would later inform the environmental justice movement. So the UAW was serious about working in inner city neighborhoods to develop a more healthful and attractive living environment. But within the union, blacks felt that some of their most immediate environmental problems weren't being addressed, those on the shop floor itself. Black workers recognized that they were being relegated to the most dangerous and dirtiest jobs in the factories. They discovered that they suffered from disproportionate health problems from these jobs. Black foundry workers called attention to the fact that they suffered from a disproportionate amount of lung cancers and related environmental diseases, yet they felt that the international union and local union leadership was unsympathetic to their calls for change. This was one of the factors that led, in fact, to the rebellion of black workers in the UAW and the formation of the revolutionary union movements. Many black workers would walk off the job in wildcat strikes and protest to the dangerous working conditions, and in some cases from in-plant air pollution that choked the air and made it difficult to breathe and see, and really made their working conditions incredibly dangerous. This is kind of out of the scope of this presentation, but it's a really interesting story in and of itself. And it shows that despite the newfound concern by the UAW for environmental issues, and efforts to address the urban crisis and inner city environmental problems, the union did a much worse job addressing any environmental inequalities on the shop floor. On April 22nd, 1970, the nation celebrated its first Earth Day. An event several months in the making and the brainchild of Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, it was, to that point, the nation's largest single-issue demonstration in its history, with some 20 million people participating, and in the view of many, really kick-started the environmental movement. As I hope I've been able to show, there was already a very vibrant environmentalism that had been developing within the UAW for several years before the first Earth Day, which is one of the reasons why the UAW was able to make a really strong presence and really strong contribution to the organization and success of that first Earth Day. The role of the UAW in helping to support the making of the first Earth Day has now mostly been forgotten. UAW President Walter Reuther was an early supporter of the idea, and in fact, the UAW was instrumental in providing volunteers and a good amount of startup funds to the organization of Earth Day. And Senator Gaylord Nelson, after the fact, effusively praised the union in the aftermath, saying, with no doubt a touch of hyperbole, that the Earth Day would not have been possible without the support of Reuther and the auto workers. One of the biggest Earth Day demonstrations in the region took place in the industrialized Downriver Detroit area. If we are to believe the newspapers, which likely overestimated, up to 1,000, but certainly several hundred workers converged on the banks of the Detroit River on both the Canadian and American sides to hold a mock funeral for the Detroit River. A campus minister from Oakland University delivered the eulogy. That minister, William Brewster, in his eulogy expressed, quote, horror at the effects of pollution, unbreathable air, undrinkable water, the disappearance of land and water life, the invasion of our bodies by untested drugs and tree removal. Mayors from the industrial suburb River Rouge and Windsor, Ontario, tossed a wreath onto the oil-covered waters and said that we are, quote, all passengers on a relatively small spacecraft called Planet Earth. Many workers wore gas masks, carrying signs, joined in chants. This boy on the right, 9-year-old Dale Vermillion, is holding the sign that says, "Do I have to die young to let industrial pollution live?" And he was a son, in fact, of an auto worker. Yet despite the important support that the UAW gave to Earth Day and the growing environmental movement, there were some signs of conflict already emerging within the environmental movement between the workers who had been on the forefront of environmental activism and the new left students who some in the UAW, including Vice President Olga Madar, criticized for being Johnny-come-latelys to environmental activism. At the University of Michigan, Walter Reuther gave an address, and the Downriver Anti-Pollution League envisioned busing workers over to Ann Arbor to witness the address and to participate in Ann Arbor's Earth Day festivities. They were dismayed, however, when they received a chilly response from the student activists in Ann Arbor. One DAPL organizer blasted the professors and students who, quote, don't seem to relate much to human problems. This has been generally true of the white middle class groups in conservation, abortion reform, clean government, etc. They seem afraid or not interested in linking up with working people, poor people, black groups, etc. I hope I'm wrong. End quote. Even at the big coming out party for the modern environmental movement, we are already beginning to witness some of the rifts that would grow in coming years. Workers and New Left students would come into conflict, arguing over what should be the most pressing issues that the environmental movement addresses, and what should be the role of factories and factory work in that vision. After the first Earth Day, the UAW worked on finding ways that they could keep the momentum going. And they were always concerned with trying to make sure that the post-Earth Day environmental movement was attentive to issues of class and the desires of the labor movement. Reuther was instrumental in helping to organize a United Nations symposium at its Black Lake conference grounds near Onaway, Michigan. But just weeks before the conference, a plane carrying Reuther and his wife crashed not far from the Black Lake site, killing Reuther, his wife, and the pilot. The conference organizers carried on and remarked that it seemed appropriate to hold an international conference on the environment at Black Lake, a cause which Reuther had embraced late in his life. The conference agenda reflected the UAW's working class environmentalism, with significant attention being paid to urban environmental issues related to class and race inequality. High on the conference agenda were the related urban crisis and environmental crisis. Years before the environmental justice movement illuminated the hidden environmental injuries of class and race, the new UAW president, Leonard Woodcock's address to the United Nations Symposium reflected a partial repudiation of the mainstream environmental movement in favor of a movement more sensitive to race and class. He said, quote, much of what still passes for environmental concern in the United States is still limited to a cosmetic approach. Sweeping streets, picking up litter, returning disposable bottles and beer cans, cleaning debris out of streams. These are wholesome pursuits, he said, but they do not get to the heart of the matter. And from the standpoint of the poor and the deprived of our urban centers, such actions are frivolous middle-class evasions of the need to end the deprivation of poverty. These were tough words and a serious indictment of the emerging middle-class environmental movement. There was a role for environmentalism in solving the problems of the urban crisis, but it shouldn't be limited to the usual cosmetic approach, he was saying, the aesthetic approach to the environment. Leonard Woodcock advocated an alternative vision of environmentalism, a social justice and working class-centered environmentalism that placed, quote, elimination of poverty and deprivation high on the agenda of the environmental campaign. And he said that he would fight for, quote, distributive justice. This linking of environmentalism and social justice was an important intersection, and one that the mainstream environmental movement unfortunately largely ignored. At the same time that the UAW tried to extend its influence nationally and even globally in the environmental, in the emerging environmental movement, it kept pushing grassroots organizing in Detroit. Some of the most significant accomplishments of the Downriver Anti-Pollution League, in fact, would occur at the beginning of the 1970s. In a joint effort between the UAW, University of Michigan School of Natural Resources, and the Downriver Anti-Pollution League, they launched a major survey effort in the Downriver Detroit area to gauge environmental and social problems. They recruited volunteers from the university. They recruited black and white high school students and members from the Downriver area. After attending training sessions, interview teams would set out on foot, canvassing the neighborhoods and asking questions like, what do you feel are the two or three most serious problems affecting the community that something will have to be done about over the next few years? The responses were really interesting. In terms of the total responses from the three communities, crime and morality was the top answer. However, all environmental problems except air pollution were the second and third most prominent answers, beating out things like racial problems, economic challenges, education, housing and population, and transportation and planning. And in the e-course community, the answer, all environmental problems, was even more popular than crime, a more popular answer than crime. This in spite of the widespread law and order rhetoric coming from the Nixon administration, and indeed the serious racial conflicts in many of these communities. The environmental survey coming so soon after the UN conference really marked the climax of community UAW partnership on local environmental issues. But the fall off in enthusiasm in its aftermath was abrupt. DAPL had been enormously successful at mobilizing local residents. At one time, it had as many as 1,100 members in Southeast Michigan. Yet internal and external challenges within the UAW would challenge the union's ability to provide leadership within working class environmentalism. And over the course of 1971, DAPL's activities dwindled, and the last meeting was finally held in 1972. Some of the other initiatives that I briefly mentioned, like the Deprived Areas Recreation Team, and some of the efforts by the UAW Recreation Department to provide more equitable parks and recreation opportunities to the inner city, would sputter on until the mid-1970s, but they were clearly becoming marginalized issues within the UAW. A number of causes account for the decline in UAW interest in working class environmentalism and grassroots anti-pollution organizing. Within the UAW, the death of Walter Reuther certainly delivered a striking blow to environmental causes, and subsequent leadership never really took up that cause with as much enthusiasm as Reuther had. Much of the rest of the leadership in the UAW is not as excited, even when Reuther was living, with the direction that he was taking the union as far as environmental issues. But you know, Reuther was such a commanding presence in that leadership that that the dissent didn't matter so much. By the early 1970s, however, the union was dealing with a number of distractions, including major strikes, of course, and economic threats to the vitality of the auto industry. These same forces also put workers themselves on the defensive. You know, it was one thing to support environmental issues when times were good, but quite another thing to support them during a period of economic downturns, spiraling inflation, and growing international competition. The chasm between the New Left environmentalists and the working class indeed only widened. There's some evidence that the membership was getting frustrated with their dues going to these sort of social unionism issues. And in fact, staffers within the UAW were told that they needed to stop focusing so much on community organizing and shift their attention back to activities which clearly served the membership's needs. So the UAW was clearly in retreat by the early 1970s and no longer had the resources and the will to try to continue to exert leadership on issues like environmentalism. And a final factor which contributed to the decline of the union's environmental efforts was the rise of environmental blackmail or jobs blackmail. Rising inflation and a sputtering economy caused many industrialists to claim the factories could not afford to implement pollution abatement measures to comply with federal law. They argued that the new environmental regulations would force them to lay off employees at a time when the country could not afford a growing unemployment rate. This pushed the UAW and other unions against a wall, and it put the UAW in a really awkward position of having to promote a moratorium on new federal car emissions regulations that they themselves had supported and really pushed for just a couple of years earlier. Just some closing thoughts. The departure of the UAW as a leading advocate of grassroots social justice-oriented environmentalism accelerated the loss during the 1970s from the larger environmental movement of the language of class, race, and justice, a language which would not reemerge for almost another decade with the environmental justice movement. As the mainstream environmental movement struggles to connect with blue-collar workers and the labor movement seeks to regain its authoritative voice in social issues, the grassroots and social justice-based environmentalism advocated by the UAW provides an important example of the rich possibilities for environmental and labor activist cooperation. There has been much talk in recent years about how to rebuild a blue-green alliance, and I think some attention to this period of working class environmentalism points the way forward. Any effort at rapprochement must be sensitive to the precarious state of unions and blue-collar jobs. It must deal with issues of local and critical importance to struggling cities like Detroit. In other words, it needs to make a better case for why globally significant issues like climate change should matter to folks getting by paycheck to paycheck. And it has to take seriously grassroots organizations and incorporate a broad variety of voices. But I think this presentation and this research on working class environmentalism shows that there is a common ground between environmentalists and workers, and recovering this history of working class environmentalism is a way forward. Thank you.
Yeah. A burial of a car at UC San Jose.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And, by the students on Earth Day or somewhere in the vicinity of
right.
Earth Day.
Mm-hmm.
So, is it a definitional thing that's going on? That, I mean, were the students burying the car and the Downriver Alliance, I mean, are they really talking about the environment as the same set of things? Or environmentalism as the same set of things, even at the outset?
You know, I don't think so, because I don't think that the folks burying the car at UC San Jose were in a position to really have to think about the consequences of their environmental protests. You know, their jobs weren't, their future employment wasn't going to be in jeopardy if they pushed this environmentalism. Whereas I think what's happening in the Downriver Detroit area and with these auto workers, why it's so interesting is that, you know, they were advocating for things that they were very cognizant could threaten their livelihoods. They were pushing for, you know, stricter emissions regulations. They were pushing for an end to the gasoline-based automobile, and they were very aware that this could be problematic. But they also were in a position of strength, and they didn't buy the industry's arguments that they couldn't do that they couldn't be making these pollution abatement efforts. They were trying to call the industries out for just not doing enough when they could. They were trying to make, you know, to sort of borrow a turn of phrase, trying to make them open up their books and really show them that they couldn't actually do this. So I don't know. I think it is two different things from the outset. And I, in spite of like some convergence, the students and working class environmentalists, I don't think ever had much of a chance to really cooperate too much. At least that's my perspective.
Other, yes.
To what extent was
It changes. And at this time, in the 1960s and early 70s, it's going to be, it's primarily white. And black workers felt like their health sort of perspectives weren't being sort of respected on the shop floor. They were being marginalized within workplaces into really dangerous and dirty jobs. And so they were trying to call attention to the fact, and they were, in many cases, interviewing each other and trying to figure out what sort of health maladies that they were facing in order to try to present a better case about their environmental health predicament. But they just really weren't being, at this point, listened to too much. I think this is one of the things where the UAW was doing a really good job of promoting this sort of community environmentalism. But when it came to on the shop floor itself, was really having a hard time pushing factories to become safer workplaces in a lot of cases, and black environmentalists were trying to say that these are our landscapes, you know, these are our environments that we're living, that we're working in, and they're just as important as the downriver areas to the people who are living there. So it will start changing towards the late 1970s, where you will see more convergence, and this starts happening, I think. The UAW starts becoming more interested in issues of cancer and environmental health, and they start doing a better job of trying to incorporate more voices from the shop floor, both black and white. So that answers your question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, all of these meetings of the United Auto Workers and so on, apparently there were numerous, did they ever discuss the automobile itself and the amount of emissions it was making and the technology needed to improve the situation? Or did they ever discuss the need for better public transportation in Detroit?
That's the interesting thing. I went into this looking specifically to take on the transportation question, looking specifically and sort of expecting to find that they might be pushing for transportation. But they just never do. They're never a very prominent voice in this public transportation issue. Yet at the same, so you can just say like cynically, well, you know, they're in the business of making automobiles. But at the same time, by the late 1960s, they are having conversations and saying that we can get rid of the internal combustion engine. It's just and they're saying they believe that the automakers have the technology to do this, and they have the technology to reduce emissions significantly. They're just not wanting to do it because they don't want to incur the cost. And so they're really trying to say, prove it to us that you can't take on these costs. And so they were actually successful, and they were a prominent voice in pushing. The EPA is formed in 1970. Asserted a lot of leadership and pushing the new EPA regulations on emissions and pushed them to be tougher than obviously the auto industry wanted them to be. But that changes really quickly, and by about 1973, they're already saying, we should probably hold back on these emissions. We should give the automakers two or three more years to come up with cleaner cars, because this is really, the economy is just in such a terrible state right now that we can't afford the job losses that might come out of this. So they were having, it's interesting that they were having conversations about trying to really cut down on emissions and get rid of the internal combustion engine, but it changes really fast after that.
Just a comment.
Sure.
Poverty business. If you reduce poverty, more people will be able to buy cars. I mean, you're right back.
Yeah. That's exactly, and that's one of the, this sort of goes to the first question, is that the students, in a lot of ways, were pushing for, like, getting rid of factories. So in some ways, kind of utopian in a lot of their efforts, and cutting down on consumption. And working class people are saying, well, if there's a consumption problem, it's the fact that we're not getting to consume enough. It's not that we're consuming too much. And so they were saying, they were coming at it from very different, you know, very different perspectives.
Let me play with you on this a little bit, because what you said in one part of this is that the UAW advocated the idea that pollution controls, you would pass along the cost to consumers. So you get a moment in the early 70s when there's a huge kind of, I think, you know, retrenchment thinking around this idea that automatically every cost has to go on to the back of consumers. So I think that there's a kind of a sea change, and that's when you get into something to the job lack. Because if consumers are not going to, if ever spiraling inflation is not going to, in effect, pay all social costs,
yeah.
If you're going to have to live within a certain amount of means, then you get into the job blackmail issue. I mean, it's night and day is kind of a way of looking at some of the stuff I think that you're raising.
Yeah.
The curtain comes down on the issue of let the consumer pay the price.
Yeah, and I think that your point about inflation is exactly right. This plays such a critical role in the 1970s in that flip.
There's also an extent where there's a kind of political economy of waste that's created, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the stuff that used to go up the smokestack or out into the river, you can't do that anymore, so it's got to go into another form. So instead of having air protection that covers everybody, you have solid waste that can get dumped in specific places. And that's where you get to the type of Robert Bullard type critique, right?
Exactly.
That's the unequal protection of environmental law.
Mm-hmm.
Environmental law creates clean air for everybody, but then puts junk in very specific places.
Yep.
Right? So it seems to me like if you're gonna try to use this story as the origins of environmental justice, that's the kind of transition you need to figure out. So when does it become a critique of environmental regulation itself?
Yeah.
Which is what most people associate environmental justice as coming out.
Yeah, I think that's a really, and that's something that I've been playing around with a lot, and I haven't figured out quite how to make that case. Because in some ways, one of the reasons why Black Detroiters didn't play a prominent story with a lot of this air and water pollution stuff is that they're not living in primarily in the downriver and industrialized areas. They're more segregated to different areas of Detroit that were, in many cases, often weren't dealing with. Weren't in quite as much proximity to the air pollution of the factories. But then once you get to the 1980s environmental justice era, yeah, a lot of those materials are being dumped like directly onto those neighborhoods, or they were putting incinerators in their neighborhoods, because that was supposedly another grand solution to the waste problem. Yeah.
Yeah. When you said the word incinerator, kind of interesting because the case here in Lansing is sort of an interesting one. There was a Fisher body plant on the west side that was originally built in the 20s when the town hadn't been there yet. As the town grew out, there was a high school located right next to auto plant that had a coal-burning power plant. And not only was the coal-burning power plant, it was also used to incinerate the paint fumes from the paint department after the 1970s. And that caused a great deal of interplay between the company, the union, and the community. The interesting story is the one when that plant was replaced, the thing that drove part of the replacement, it's kind of a little bit of a complicated story, because originally the plant was going to be built, 9/11 happened, and it was postponed when the environment environmental permits were going to expire if the company continued with the project. And the new plant is the first LEED certified auto plant in the United States, I think maybe even in the world. And the story also has a little bit behind it about the differences in the modern era, this diversity you're talking about, convergence between environmental groups that came and met with us and suggested to us that we should get rid of our paint department and put out cars that would not have any sort of chance in the marketplace to sell. And of course, would be less polluting. And our plan, which was kind of to have do baseline studies of the wetlands around the plant, to have a plant that would qualify as environmentally friendly, which it did ultimately. And then another further irony is how the company never then publicized that or used it in any sort of marketing way, that here was a place that produced a car that was done in an environmentally friendly setup.
Yeah, that's surprising that that wasn't marketed. That seems like a missed opportunity.
But it is an interesting continuation of the story that you kind of laid out.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, let me ask a question about migration, because naturally, long ago, the people were living in the same neighborhoods as the factories, as Mark just spoke to. But you know, with the rise of I-96, with the rise of I-94, you automatically get the out-migration to suburbs where the factories are not. And does that migration, along with the fact that what the good UAW wage creates is the second home up north?
Yeah.
So then my recreation and my interest in environmentalism very well may shift to where the factory is or where the old neighborhood was, where black people now live without me. To, you know, whether or not I've got a good environment in Brighton, and also whether or not I have a good environment, you know, either on the Sunset or Sunrise Coast.
Yeah.
So, can you speak to that at all? That whole migration as a part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, that's another reason why it really becomes difficult for this continuation of environmental activism, is that a lot of people now have different environmental interests once they get their second home, once they're moving out to the suburbs. Actually, in my larger project, I do like talk much more about the metropolitanization of Detroit and the regionalization of Detroit. So I go more into that there, and I think it's critical, and it really creates some uncomfortable discussions within the UAW, because they do still have a lot of, like, tens of thousands of members living within the city limits. But suddenly the ones that had moved out to the suburbs don't want to support the same kinds of things that are going on in Detroit. It actually creates really awkward conversations with the busing situation in the early 1970s. And I think that's another example of how messages started to get mixed once you have different interests being represented in the metropolitan area.
Other questions or comments for Brandon? For those of you who don't know the location and the illusion, Black Lake, the Family Education Center that the UAW runs in Ottawa, Michigan, was designed by Walt Ruther, along with the architect who was also killed, Oscar Stoneron. But it's based on the whole European Scandinavian model of having education centers that are that are truly strong family recreation centers. So I mean, it's far away from Detroit in a way that you can be without going over the Mackinac Bridge. And it's interesting in terms of kind of that UAW in the garden, the machine in the garden.
Yeah.
Notion.
Yeah.
And suddenly you get, you know, factory workers who, in effect, are now in a place where they normally would not spend time as urban workers from Detroit, who now suddenly are in the Great North, where a lot of other folks had been spending time, but Black Lake is a symbol, in fact, of that kind of image of what Ruther had of how workers would recreate, and it was definitely in the Great Wilds rather than also for the long of those.
Yep. And it gets wrapped up into all kinds of ideologies, like this is where you're going to find democracy, and this is going to be the bulwark against communism, is out in nature where you're going to get a true education, and where you can find, you know, demonstrate your virility and your masculinity, and yeah, absolutely.
It was interesting, as you look at the history of Black Lake, this was before the rise of energy costs, you know, energy, yep. wind energy. And of course, as soon as he dies in the subsequent administrations, those are the first things that disappear.
Yep. I think that's the perfect way to end this.
Well, let's thank Brandon one more time.